you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Jim Flynn, and I'm here on behalf of Rush University Medical Center. With me at counsel's table is our Chicago counsel, Ken Krause, of the law firm of Schaff & Weiss. Of the four issues presented to you for review today, I'd like to begin with the issue pertaining to the disproportionate share hospital adjustment that's often referred to as DISH. And at issue, obviously, there is the program memorandum.
I hope you will avoid.
I can if you'd like, Your Honor. A few comments, however, about the program memorandum, which is really at issue before I get into the specific application of it to Rush. I believe that we can perhaps all agree that it's not the easiest thing to read the first time through, and it maybe lacks some of the precision and refinement that we may see in a regulation that's published in a Federal Register or maybe in a court's opinion. But I nevertheless believe that this program memorandum can be subjected to a plain language reading, and I'd like to suggest that this court should look no further than the plain language for at least three reasons. One is a standard.
But before you get into your reasons, Mr. Flynn, honestly, you know, I didn't know this many people in the country had flunked English. It's dense at best, and if you're going to give it the benefit of the doubt, it seems to me that the Secretary was trying to resolve a number of problems that were before, as the case may be, him or her. One of the problems was, what do you do with these general assistance people? One of the problems was, what do you do with the fact that there was confusion abroad, and how are you going to handle reliance interests? There were a whole lot of things, and through this dense mass of verbiage that's this program memorandum, the Secretary resolves this. And so it's up to us to figure out what, in fact, they said. I'm not sure that using the phrase plain language helps us too much in that process.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, a couple of points on that. First of all, I think that you have to keep in mind that the program memorandum is a result of confusion that the Secretary, the agency, created themselves. Their contractors created that confusion.
Well, Congress may have helped.
Congress helped. Congress certainly was applying political pressure, and that's the second point I'd make. If you look at the history, and unfortunately the briefing limitations before in this case didn't allow me to go fully into this history, but if you look at St. Joseph's, for instance, you can see this in some of these cases. There was political pressure being applied to the agency in October of 99 on this confusion, and this program memorandum was a result of that, and I suggest it was probably hastily drafted to respond to a number of political constituents.
But getting to the point, I mean, you have 20 minutes, I know there are a lot of things. It seems to me that the agency has now taken the position, they have this program memorandum, they interpret it as something which requires hospitals to have, as I read it, frankly, both to have asked for this general assistance reimbursement before the magic date of October, whatever it was, 1999, and you should either have had an appeal pending, you know, there are these various options, an appeal pending, or the one that you seem really to be pushing, adding to your later appeal something that you had earlier raised, but you didn't ask for GA reimbursement in the 91 request.
Actually, we did in 89 and 90. And
but
in
you
years,
did it in 91.
In years prior to that.
You did not in 1991.
You're right, Your Honor. And I think there could be a couple of reasons
that's
to
explain
point,
that. That's the point, though. That's the 91 year that we're dealing with.
That's true, Your Honor. And if you look at the program memorandum, what it is trying to do is trying to capture whether Rush is a genuine belief hospital, whether they maintain that genuine belief. The program memorandum gives you two options.
I don't know that I would phrase it that way. I know that's how you want to phrase it, but does Rush actually fall into the group of hospitals that received general assistance money and now would have to perhaps disgorge it now that the Secretary has finally clarified what's going on here? Rush didn't receive it for 91 because it never asked for it for 91.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. So my focus then is on the second part of the Hold Harmless, which talks about those hospitals that did not receive it. And the way I draw the genuine belief, besides the way the agency has described it as well, is that they look at hospitals that appealed it previously, either in the 91 appeal, they appealed it prior to 99, or they appealed it in prior years. And that evidence of prior appeal, previously appealing the issue is another indication that the program memorandum was trying to protect those that had genuinely believed it in the past.
So then, is that then the answer to the question, why didn't Rush use the language that they had used for 89 and 90 and 91? Is that the reason?
To be honest,
it had been requested before, so you fit somehow into the category?
To be honest, Your Honor, that question really was never asked at the administrative level, and it's really, we were left to speculate about that, I'm afraid. But I think you could very easily read into the fact that it had been claimed and denied in prior years that Rush was frustrated by its attempts to continually report this and get it denied.
Well, you know how I see this case? I think Rush had the bad luck to have an intermediary who anticipated where the Secretary was finally going to come out. So it was, as it were, correctly interpreting this arrangement. You didn't ask for the GA days in 1991. You didn't appeal the issue before October 15, 1999. That's your sentence three. And so you're trying to kind of squeeze yourself into five, but then the Secretary has... The Secretary understands you as only adding this issue in 2002.
Right. So the Secretary wants to ignore sentence 5 and say sentence 7 carries the day.
I don't think they're ignoring sentence 5 at all. I think they're reading that as looking at a new appeal after October 1599.
But I think there are some reasons you have to read, and again, I know it's not the most artfully worded thing, but when you read sentence 5, it doesn't talk about just a jurisdictionally proper appeal. It talks about a jurisdictionally proper appeal on the issue of disproportionate share. And if you read that they did not have that jurisdictionally proper appeal issue on that issue before 99, i.e. sentence 3, then you have to conclude that they had it after 99, because they clearly had a jurisdictionally proper appeal with the issue in it. The matter is now, when did that issue become part of the appeal? Keep in mind that the PRRB procedures allow parties to add issues all the way up to the eve of hearing.
Then what are you going to do with Section 7 that refers to appeals that are already pending on October 1599?
What I do with Sentence 7 is apply it to United Hospital and a whole bunch of other hospitals that didn't bother litigating it like United Hospital did. They didn't have the issue identified in a prior appeal, and they didn't have the issue identified prior to 99. The hold harmless comes out. Sentence 7 knocks them out. And I suggest to you that if sentence 7 was intended to trump sentence 5, then just like they did in sentence 5 and sentence 8, sentence 7 should have also said something about notwithstanding prior history of appeals.
Then it would have been even longer.
Clearly we all could have drafted it differently. But I think the problem with the Secretary's reading and the district court's reading is that it doesn't give meaning to the entirety of it. You can't. They can only rely on sentence 7 if they get past sentence 5.
It sounds like a request for us just to construe it as if it were a statute rather than the Secretary's own program manual. But as I understand the Supreme Court's rules, the Secretary gets to construe his own writings. Why, if there is any room for doubt, do we not say the Secretary's understanding of that program manual prevails?
Well, I think this is where I would emphasize the history that the Secretary has displayed of always interpreting it in the way that is to the disadvantage of the hospital.
Surprise.
And then when you
that's,
also...
That's been clear about agency behavior for more than 100 years, but that still leaves in place the Supreme Court's rule for resolving doubt. When an agency resolves doubt about its own documents, the court is supposed to accept the agency's reading. You can't say something that's been true of agencies since the beginning of time as a reason to depart from that interpretive norm.
And I'm clearly not. I'm clearly not going to ask you to do that.
You just did ask us to do
that. But I'm going to suggest to you that when you consider the level of deference that you give, that you don't necessarily give it the same level of deference here, where they created the confusion and that we're forced to try to clean it up, and they did it after the fact in an inartful way. You're rewarding them for their inartful drafting, and then they get to interpret however they want down the road. What kind of guidance does that really give to hospitals? I suppose the other point to emphasize here is that if the program memorandum is allowed to be selectively applied to hospitals the way the agency wants to do it, then What is the hospital's, how can the hospital know what guidance is out there? Keeping in mind, of course, that prior to 1999, the hospitals didn't even know what the program memorandum was going to say. And so now you are penalizing the hospitals for not being omniscient enough.
No, if I understand what's going on here, the concern is that the hospitals, on getting hold of the program manual, would try to use the language, try to conform their behavior to the language, and that's to get a benefit that was not a result of their genuine ex ante confusion. And therefore, the manual says, we're going to cut off claims on a certain date. And if there's any problem in reading the manual, what the manual is trying to do is cut off claims so that it doesn't affect the claiming process.
And I don't have any problem with that, and I understand that policy objective. I think that's been
advanced. But then I don't understand what your argument is. You said we should construe the manual in a particular way, and I then say, but look, the manual says it's cut off precisely to avoid any confusion about the manual leading to things.
Let me try to clarify.
Well, I'm now lost about what your position is.
Let me try to clarify. I'm advocating that you can stop at the plain language of the program memorandum. As inartful as that may be, I think you can stop at the plain language. And the reason that I suggest that is that because if you look at the Secretary's arguments.
Look, if the language were plain, we wouldn't be here.
Okay.
I urge you to stop arguing plain language. It's not a plausible argument.
Okay. But if you look at the I appreciate that. If you look at the Secretary's arguments and the district court's rationalization, they are adding context to this program memorandum that had never been promulgated before until these pleadings. They're creating new context to try to justify sentence 5 that didn't exist before.
Well, and why isn't a synonym for what you just said that they're looking at what you're referring to and everybody's referring to is sentence 5, and they're looking at sentence 7, and they are indicating the way they think those two things ought to be read together. And even if we granted you that it might be possible to read them with a little more emphasis on sentence 7 or with a little more on 5, as Chief Judge Easterbrook said, it's their memorandum. Can't they tell us what they meant?
They can, and that's what they're doing, although they didn't do it at the agency level. They're now doing it at the court level. So I'll suggest to you that it's a post hoc rationalization of what the program memorandum says. But
their bottom line at the agency level was that you weren't entitled to these general assistance days.
Though they only focused on sentence 7. They didn't focus on sentence 5 at all.
Okay.
And in fact, if you look at the administrative agency's decision, they don't even include sentence 5 anywhere in their decision. The problem with interpreting sentence 5 the way the government has advocated here at the appellate level is that it puts two hospitals that are essentially in the same position of having a prior history of appeals in disparate positions for no reason related to the rational basis of the program memorandum.
Why isn't the reason that Chief Judge Easterbrook mentioned precisely that reason, trying to distinguish between those who genuinely relied and had some ex ante history that showed that the agency could be confident of, and those who may simply have been trying to take advantage of a new opportunity in this memorandum?
Because if you have two, but both hospitals had the same prior history of appeals, so they both had the prior belief that they were entitled to the GA days. The only difference between the two hospitals doesn't have to do with the program memorandum. It has to do with the maturity of their cost report. One of their cost reports is up for appeal within 180 days. The other is not. So I don't see the connection to the rational basis or the reason for the program memorandum if that's the reason, if that's how you're going to interpret sentence 5. The other thing about that interpretation is it talks about they think sentence 5 only applies to hospitals that haven't had a chance to appeal yet. If you look at the language of sentence 5, it uses language like do not open, reopen, or do not revise a cost report. Well, you can only reopen a cost report if it's closed. You can only revise a cost report if it's closed. So I think that is inconsistent with what they're now advocating is the purpose behind sentence 5. And then I would add, you also have sentence 8 already addressing the very same issue for those hospitals that do have open appeals. If you had an open appeal, sentence 8 addressed, I'm sorry, you still had the window of opportunity to appeal, sentence 8 addressed that situation. I'd like to focus. I know we have focused a lot on sentence 5, but I do want to spend a moment on sentence 3. And the reason that I want to spend a moment on that is that the confusion that we're addressing with this program memorandum is whether general assistant days were also a state medical assistance program. Medicaid is a state medical assistance program. And so the confusion was that those two terms were synonymous for purposes of disproportionate share reimbursement. The genuine belief that the program memorandum was attempting to capture addressed whether general assistance was treated the same. The ruling in 1997 used the term Medicaid and state medical assistance program days. And so there again, you're looking at the confusion that was created in 1997 is what days go in the Medicaid calculation.
Actually, before we get too much further, I want to rewind you back to the beginning. I should have asked this before you even got going, and it is, do we have an appealable judgment? Now, I know you filed separate memos on the question whether the remand, if there was a remand, made the judgment non-final. And I want to ask you about this contingent clause, if there was a remand. I looked for the final judgment in this case to see what the terms of the remand were and who won what. And there's a document that's on Rule 58 judgment paper, and it says, each side's motion for summary judgment is granted in part and denied in part, period. Which means, to me at least, that there has been no judgment in this case, because a judgment has to say what relief the prevailing party gets. And we have said, pretty much till we're blue in the face, that granting a motion is different from specifying the prevailing party's relief. Is there some judgment in this record that I've missed that says the relief to which each side is entitled?
Your Honor, I can't speak beyond the same documents that you've seen. I can't recall whether the judgment order said consistent with the memorandum and opinion, but the memorandum and opinion is where you obviously see the remand language and the judgment.
There is no remand in the judgment.
Correct.
There is no nothing in the judgment. So far as I can see, there has been nothing remanded to anyone. There has been no relief, and this case remains pending in the district court. It's not clear what we're doing here.
Well, I would suggest that the order that was granted, or the motion for summary judgment that was granted for Rush, was not appealed by the government.
There hasn't been a final judgment. The time to appeal hasn't begun to run.
Your Honor, I cannot speak to the sufficiency of the court's judgment. I really can't.
Well, perhaps we need supplemental filings on this question. But the most sensible thing to do is for the two parties to repair to the district court and get it to enter a final judgment in this case. If there's to be a remand, the judgment has to specify the terms of the remand. If there's to be relief, that is, who won how much money, who lost, it has to be in the judgment. And I can't understand how sophisticated lawyers on either side could look at this document and believe that the district court had finished its work.
Your Honor, I guess I will follow your direction on that. If there's a question about the remand part of it, I can
speak
to that.
There is no remand part of it.
Okay.
There has been no remand.
I think I mean in the opinion piece of it. But
yeah, well.
I understand your point. I'll go ahead and leave the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Flynn. Mr. Miller. Miller, with you, I will manage to start with the jurisdictional issue. Is there some document that I'm missing that actually orders a remand and specifies relief, or is that mystery piece of paper it?
I think the court has accurately described the situation. There's
well,
the
why didn't you go to the district judge and say, excuse me, you have not entered the final judgment in this case. Why don't you do that?
Well, I suppose we should have done it based on what the court is saying, and we will
based
certainly go
back.
Based on
what's in the document, right? If you get a document from a court that is not a final judgment, why don't you tell the court, that's what rules like Rule 59 are for, saying, please, here's your problem, please fix it.
We should do that.
So I trust the two of you will do it. And then, Mr. Flynn, I advise you, you probably need to file a new notice of appeal once you get a final judgment. And we can then resolve the case on the new notice of appeal and the old briefs.
Once there's a final judgment, we would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision because it correctly found that the secretary's actions were rational and supported by substantial evidence and not plainly erroneous. The district court was also correct in noting the highly deferential standard of review that applies to this case because this case does focus on the secretary's interpretation of his own regulations and because the Medicare program is a complex regulatory program requiring a substantial amount of administrative expertise.
Mr. Miller, I had a question which came to my mind when I was looking at this remand for the D2 worksheet, and I was trying to understand how much financial consequence there is. I take it if there's an approved graduate medical program, then there's a certain level of reimbursement, although it looked to me like it was some mushy standard of an appropriate share of allowable costs, whatever that means. And if it's an unapproved program, then you get to file this D2 worksheet and you get 80% of some number?
That's correct. It's an alternate route to getting some reimbursement
so
for those other residents.
Is it sort of structurally the case that you'll always get less money with the D2 worksheet, or is it possible that they'll wind up with the same amount of money except more paperwork with the or the same amount of paperwork? What's the difference between these two avenues?
I think the avenue they pursued can ultimately lead to more reimbursement than the worksheet.
So if the graduate medical education program in neuroradiology, for example, is an approved program in some world, I know it's your position that it wasn't approved here, but if it were an approved program, then that would yield more money to the hospital than going the unapproved D2 worksheet route.
That's my understanding, but we did not go into the
amounts.
It's hard
to get that out of the regulations, to be honest. I mean, I looked at them, and I couldn't figure out what, in whose eyes an appropriate share of allowable costs was measured and whether that and what the 80% number related to.
And I want to be clear, I don't know that with certainty because the record in this case doesn't go into exactly what amount of reimbursement they can collect going through the worksheet D route. So none of that is in the administrative record or the briefs that we filed in this case.
I'm surprised it's not just a known fact about the way this regulatory system, I mean, I certainly don't spend time in this regulatory system aside from preparing for this case. And so it seems to me somebody must know. I mean, there must be a reason why you try to have an approved program. I assume out of common sense that that's because you get more money, but sometimes you like to be a little more precise about that.
It may also be a simpler route administratively. I think part of the reason that Rush may have not pursued the worksheet D route is because more documentation is required, and actually that was one of the issues that was talked about at the administrative level. But again, I want to be clear, I don't know that in depth because that's not something that was actually adjudicated at the administrative level or discussed in any of the briefs at this level.
And I had one other question on these graduate programs. Well, actually, no, this is the full-time equivalent people. With respect to Drs. Miles and Wong, the Secretary stresses that Rush didn't furnish the rotation schedule for these doctors. Okay, that's fine. I understand that point. But they did furnish the rotation schedule for Dr. Mushin, and that was somehow deemed not to be good evidence that he was in an allowable program part of the hospital, how you put it. So why does the rotation sheet not suffice to make Dr. Mushin one FTE?
There's a couple of reasons. One is because in addition to the rotation sheet, a Rush representative told the intermediary that was evaluating these reimbursements that Dr. Mushin worked in the JRB clinic.
Right, but I looked at that evidence, and that seems to be, you know, some unknown person with unknown expertise tells some other person And I realize hearsay rules don't apply literally here, but it strikes me that this is awfully remote as compared to the concrete evidence of the rotation sheet.
Well, I think the rotation sheet had problems, too. The rotation sheet showed the JRB clinic as being the unit or department for most of Dr. Musin's rotations.
But the brief said it places him at Rush. Now, does that mean at a specific place at Rush? Or does
no.
that could that possibly mean at Rush, meaning the JRB facility? What does
well,
that mean?
I think they did distinguish between the JRB clinic and Rush. So it's just saying Rush. But it is not telling you where in Rush. And that's precisely the problem. It's ambiguous. There are also excluded areas at Rush. So just saying that he wasn't at JRB because there wasn't the JRB notation and therefore he was at Rush still doesn't give you the answer. It doesn't tell you whether or not he was in one of the excluded areas.
So when they fill out these rotation schedules, it just says, I mean, Rush is actually a huge facility. It just says you're at Rush?
Well, that was actually the testimony given, that the documentation that was provided to the intermediary showed the rotations that Dr. Musin and the other residents did. And like I said, most of them actually, for Dr. Musin, said JRB. But there was one rotation that did not have JRB. I'm sorry, one part of his rotation did not have JRB next to it.
And so it was just blank? It didn't say where he was?
Exactly. And that's why it's ambiguous. And that's why the intermediary said, well, we can't tell. It's your burden to prove. You have to show us where the doctor was. You didn't do that by just telling us he was somewhere at Rush other than JRB. That's what they did. And I would add to that as well that the Secretary's regulations address this issue very precisely, and what they say is they want the hospital to provide a list of all the residents that were working at the hospital providing services on the day on the count date. And they also want to know what unit or department each of those residents was working in. So neither of those things are fulfilled by what the hospital did in this case.
Sounds like what the Secretary really wants is for the hospital to use surgery to insert a little GPS tracker in the wrist of every physician, and then they would be located for sure at some critical time. I believe that procedure was used in Star Trek.
That would be useful, but they've asked for something pretty simple here that's not onerous. They've just asked for a simple list. And, of course, there's a very good reason for this rule, which is to avoid exactly this sort of litigation. You don't have to talk about it for years afterward if you just have a simple list.
You could stamp barcodes on their forehead and have barcode readers track them as they
move
from one room to another. Yeah.
There are other methods as well. And, of course, the Secretary has the discretion to pick what he thinks is the most efficient and reasonable method. And that's exactly what the Secretary did in this case.
Is the Secretary contemplating anything more onerous than, say, lawyers filling out billable hour sheets?
As far as the residents?
The kind of records they are expecting to keep. Lawyers in most firms are required to keep track of their billable hours.
Right. I think it's
much... Is the Secretary looking at something along that lines of difficulty?
I think it's much simpler than that, to be honest. They're not asking for every day, every hour. They're asking for where was the resident on this one day. That's why there's a count date, so you don't have to keep track of this all the time. Let's make it efficient. Let's have just one count date. Tell us where all your residents are on that one date, and tell us what unit or department they're working in on that one date. Don't give us indirect testimony about where they might not have been working because of their area or a blank on a sheet or anything else like that. Let me now turn to sentence 3 of the program memo, because that's where much of this starts. The district court correctly found that Rush should not be held harmless for a number of reasons. First, because Rush did not submit the general assistance days with its cost report back in 1991. Second, because Rush did not raise the GA days issue when it took an administrative appeal in 1994. Third, because Rush also failed to raise the same GA days issue in its 1998 position paper. And then fourth, because Rush's 1998 position paper included an amount in controversy which was much less than it should have been if they were really raising this issue.
But then, I understand the Secretary's position at base to be that if you're going to raise the GA issue, you've got to do it with specificity, and this didn't meet what the Secretary thinks is the threshold.
That's correct. That's exactly right. That's what the program memo is aimed at, saying you have to raise the specific issue of these days. That's the language used. And they didn't do it here. The argument that they try and make is that they did do it in the 1998 position paper, because that position paper referred to ruling 97-2, which was from 2 years earlier. That argument doesn't work, because ruling 97-2 only addressed a very special category of Medicaid days where the hospital did not receive payment or reimbursement for some reason or another. Often it's just a mistake. They don't receive payment for that date. In contrast to that, the general assistant days are non-Medicaid days that are covered by some state program that is more generous or more broad than the Medicaid coverage. Those are two very fundamentally different types of days. On the one hand, you have Medicaid days where the hospital didn't get paid. On the other hand, you have non-Medicaid days where the state paid for it because there was a more generous program in some sense. And because those two types of days are very, very different from each other, Rush did not raise the issue in its 1998 position paper. Rush also makes an argument about magic words and says that that's what the secretary's requiring, citing to a district court case, St. Joseph's. That argument doesn't work because that St. Joseph's case really is I would call it a magic location case, not a magic words case. And what it says is that if the general assistance issue is raised in the attachment to a notice of appeal, then that is sufficient. But, of course, in this case, Rush did not raise the GA days issue in the attachments to the appeal or in the notice of appeal itself. So, of course, the St. Joseph case does not help it. Rush also attempts to criticize the line drawing that has been done by the secretary here. But the fact is it's a very understandable line that the secretary tried to draw, although the language is imprecise in the way the court has talked about. What the secretary was trying to do was distinguish between cases that genuinely relied on the GA days and genuinely believed they were covered versus hospitals that did not.
Let me ask you a question about the inn at University Village. Rush argues that the logical endpoint of your argument is that any time it gets money from anywhere, that it deposits in its general accounts, you're going to say that it's the kind of thing that that is used for these non-medical, non-patient procedures, and that gets offset or doesn't get the offsets, I should say, really.
That's not correct as far as what the secretary's position is. The secretary's position is that if you have all these other factors in place, all this other evidence in place that shows what the loan was really used for, then the secretary can draw that alternative conclusion. So the substantial evidence in this case that the secretary relied upon was, first of all, the timing and the amounts of the loan. The loan is $10 million. The inn costs $9.8 million. The timing is they took out the loan just a couple months after they started constructing the inn.
But the $10 million also, I thought, corresponded to reimbursement for all of these things that were listed on the schedule.
That's true as far as the medical equipment, but there's many other factors as well. So let me add to that. There's the fact that the medical equipment had already been purchased and paid for more than 6 months to 23 months before the loan was taken out.
But didn't they tell the Illinois lender that that's what they wanted it for? I mean, it sounds like essentially the secretary is saying that they were defrauding this Illinois lending agency.
We don't think the court has to reach that conclusion. There's also the other evidence, which is Rush's own accounting books, which associate the interest on the loan with the inn. And then on top of that, there's the notations of Arthur Anderson, which was Rush's accountant, saying directly that the loan was used to pay for the inn. So that's probably the most important evidence. But getting back to the question, we don't think the court has to conclude that there was any sort of fraud against the lender in this case, because there is sufficiently vague language in the loan document, especially the part about this money can be used to reimburse the hospital for the medical equipment you already bought. Well, that kind of sounds like, okay, you can put this money into your general operating fund to reimburse for those old purchases, and then you can take it out now to use it for the inn. So maybe that opens the door, that creates some ambiguity, maybe that's the purpose. We don't think the court needs to get into whether or not they actually violated the law. But we do think the court should find that there was substantial evidence here, because there was all these other factors. And again, I would point to the key evidence here is really Rush's own work papers attributed the interest on this loan to the inn. And the work papers of Rush's accountant said directly that the money from this loan was used for the inn. That's all you need to have substantial evidence if you're the secretary. And even if there's some evidence on the other side, again, the secretary's decision should be upheld because it's just a very deferential substantial evidence standard. If there are no further questions at this point, we would ask that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Flynn?
Just a couple of brief points on the issues covered in Mr. Miller's argument. First of all, I'll go ahead and give my answer to the question about the D2 reimbursement. It is less under D2, but a lot of that's not developed in the record because the hospital obviously applied for the reimbursement first as an approved program, right. And the point of the remand is to try to find out what the reimbursement would be. But I think practically speaking, you're correct, Your Honor. And then the last point I want to make is just about the inn. The problem with the Secretary's argument is that they have $10 million being used for $20 million worth of purchases, and they seem to admit that fact, and that's the difficulty I don't think they can escape. And then lastly, when you look at the Arthur Anderson audit papers, don't just stop where the Secretary has stopped. If you look at all of the Arthur Anderson documents into the evidence, the ultimate conclusion was that Arthur Anderson did a compliance audit and found that Rush did use the $10 million worth of loan proceeds for the projects described in the exhibit. So if there are no further questions, I'll leave the rest of the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flynn. And just a reminder, Mr. Flynn, Mr. Miller, we are expecting you to go and get us a final judgment, or get you a final judgment, which can then be appealed again. Thank you very much. The case is under advisement.